Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Why do you rob banks? That was the question put to Willie Sutton. His answer is infamous. He said, that's where the money is. The same question could be put to many corporations. Why are you working with government anti-poverty programs? Well, that's where the money is. $900 billion a year is sloshing around federal poverty programs. Circling back quickly to Sutton, the bank robber was given the nickname the Actor because he was known for donning elaborate and convincing costumes in his heist. The same could be said for these corporations getting rich on anti-poverty funds. They are disguised in doing public good. In fact, they are filling the pockets of their stockholders and private equity firms while providing dialysis and other medical care, unnecessary dentistry on children, affordable housing, private prisons, and doing the taxes for many of the most vulnerable in our society while skimming off the top. Ann Kim investigated the poverty industry. She is a writer, a lawyer, a public policy expert, and she has a new book out called Poverty for Profit, How Corporations Get Rich Off America's Poor. And Ann Kim, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
Our phone number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You've got a question, a comment about private corporations, privatization, the public services. Where does money come from? Where does it go? How well is the public served? We'd love to hear from you. You can also send us an email to thesource@tpr.org. So, Kim, I'd love to know, first off, your point of view. Are you coming to this argument, these observations, this investigation, as someone who is an anti-capitalist?
I'm not, actually. I don't have business is good. Business built America. But I think there is kind of a fundamental contradiction here between the aims of capitalism and the aims of social service programs. There's kind of a fundamental conflict between the reduction of poverty, say, and the welfare of citizens and the pursuit of profit. And this is where I think created the opportunities for companies to come in and make money at the expense of the well-being of a lot of our most vulnerable citizens.
This your book gets at the heart of the central question that I have frequently when I talk about government and things. It is like, what is the appropriate role of government in our lives? What is the appropriate role of business? You know, what should they be doing? And there's an inherent tension between the two. But here we have a Venn diagram where they overlap. And I think the central question that defines whether you're a liberal or a conservative, you know, what do you think about these that question, is kind of like muddled, you know. So do you see that central question, you know, what is the appropriate role of government and business in our lives in your writing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is a tension that I explore throughout the book. And there's another tension in here, too, and that is what taxpayers are willing to provide to people who are poor. There is an ongoing struggle, I think, in our politics to decide whether poverty is the result of quote unquote personal choice or personal responsibility, and others who say the poverty is the result of systemic and structural disadvantages that people face. A big strain throughout our politics is this idea of the deserving poor. You have to work in order to earn benefits. That's what animated the 1996 welfare reform that President Clinton signed into law. It put a time limit on welfare benefits and then put work requirements. And that's kind of like the public bargain. If you work, you're entitled to benefits. If you work, that's why you get vouchers, so that taxpayers know that the money is going to housing or to food. But again, the problem here is that this creates complexity. Complexity creates places for companies to come in and arbitrage this tension between, you know, what we think poor people in America are entitled to, the kinds of services that people are entitled to, who should provide those services, And that, I think, creates a lot of interstices within policy for exploitation, to lack for lack of a better word, of all of these uncertainties and tensions and ambivalence about how we treat poverty in America.
So we don't trust people who are impoverished with giving them the direct assistance, like a cash allowance. So instead,
Correct.
we come up with these voucher systems. And as you said, that brings in all this complexity in administering these programs and keeping track of all these things. But the inherent distrust comes from, well, they could be spending the money on something inappropriate, like beer or something.
Right.
And then why can't that just be eliminated? Why can't we just fix that?
Well, I don't think our politics would allow that to happen. It is one, and then number two, there's an inherent distrust of government as well. That's the other tension here, beginning in the 1980s with Ronald Reagan, who made hay on this idea that business can do better than government in providing government services. He succeeded in ushering in the privatization of a huge part of government, including our social service infrastructure. There are two commissions that he pulled together in 1984 and in 1988. And remember, the 80s too was also this time when Americans really glorified the CEO. We were reading biographies of Lee Iacocca and what he did with Chrysler, and Jack Welch, and God love us, Donald Trump with the art of the deal. So there was this mythology around what the CEO and business can do, and how government was failing. And of course, Reagan famously said the government is not the solution but the problem. You marry this probably misguided belief that within the realm of social services, business can deliver these services better than government can, with this idea that poor people have to be quote unquote deserving to get services. And you have this really uncomfortable Frankenstein monster of a social services system where we don't trust government, we don't trust poor people, and all the power is sitting in these companies that have access to at least $900 billion a year in federal money that's going into programs that disproportionately or primarily impact low-income Americans.
And I remember in 1980, we were in a deep recession at the time in this country, and a lot of these corporations were seeing their profit margins dry up, and they were looking around and saying, well, where is the money? Well, the government has the money. Let's figure out a way to go after that. And they came up with a plan to saying, let's privatize these services that the government is providing. They said that we can do it better. We can do it cheaper, and we could also make a profit from it. And so we're going to hit this break. But when I come back, I just don't understand how that makes any sense, that they can say we can do it bigger, better, but with also making a handsome profit at the same time. And the only way you can do that, if there's got to be cuts somewhere, and if those cuts are coming at the expense of the most vulnerable in our society. So we're going to jump on that. That's our leaping off point. We'll get back to that when we come back from the break. We do want to hear from our listeners. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And this is the book, Poverty for Profit: How Corporations Get Rich Off America's Poor. We're having a discussion with the author, Ann Kim, and we'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Self-serving private interests have hijacked the war on poverty. Failures in governance and public policy have enabled predatory industries to thrive at the expense of low-income Americans and of taxpayer dollars. That's what part of the conclusion found in the book, The Poverty for Profit: How Corporations Get Rich Off America's Poor. We're joined by the author, Ann Kim. You can call in with a question and comment about what are your thoughts about poverty for profit, 833-877-8255. So to that central question, I mean, how are they managing to make a profit providing the services that government agencies were doing, you know, at cost?
Yeah. So the book actually has chapters on each of the kind of industries. Of that $900 billion, a lot of it goes to healthcare, but you also have tax credits, you have food stamps, you have housing, you have job training, you have school lunch. So each chapter kind of deals with this industry, the mini industry that's grown up around this program, each program. But I think there's another way to think about the universe of companies that profit off poverty, and you can kind of divide them up in three different categories. You know, you can think of them as the skimmers, the monopolist contractors, and then the opportunists. So an example of the skimmers, for example, you've mentioned the tax prep companies in the introduction. And those are the folks who prepare federal tax returns for people who qualify for, say, the federal earned income tax credit. So in Texas, that returned about $7 billion to families in Texas. And probably a significant share of that went to franchise chains, you know, Liberty Tax or Jackson Hewitt or whatever, who charge pretty exorbitant fees both for the preparation of taxes, but also for high cost refund anticipation loan products so people can get their money faster. So that's an example of the skimmers. Dollar stores that make their money off of food stamps, that's another example. The monopolist contractors, great example of that again, right in Texas, is a company like Maximus, which runs the welfare system in the state. They're the ones, not the state of Texas, but this contractor who decides whether you're eligible for benefits, how much you're going to get, and possibly whether you're denied.
Yeah, when you say runs, that's a generous way of describing what they actually do, because they're infamous for not actually providing an ineffective, efficient service.
No, that's right. And that is one of the most significant drawbacks of privatization. You have no accountability, oftentimes, for these contractors that are provided. In the case of Medicaid managed care, for instance, Texas has mostly Medicaid managed care at this point. A lot of times, the state pays a fee per person who's enrolled, right? And so in order for the insurance company to profit, they have to keep the cost of the care low because they get that difference between what they're paid by the state versus what they actually paid out in care. So the incentive is there to deny care. So for instance, in Iowa, which privatized Medicaid back around 2015, when they audited what happened with Medicaid managed care, they found that illegal denials for care rose by 900%. From the time of privatization because of this incentive to deny the care in order to reap the profits. I will also add that the company that Iowa hired for its first privatization, a company called WellCare, four of its executives had been prosecuted and convicted for Medicaid fraud, which they failed to disclose. Iowa hired them anyway. So that's another downside, I think, of privatization. So that's the monopolist contractors. And then the third category of profiteers, I would say, are the opportunists. And these are the industries that make bank off of the existence of persistent poverty. So for example, the dialysis companies that you mentioned, kidney disease and kidney failure disproportionately strike low-income and minority communities because of the decades of disparities in access to care. Medicare pays for dialysis in America. Medicare pays for two-thirds of the dialysis treatments in America are provided by only two companies, DaVita and Fresenius. I happened to look up just on Google how many dialysis centers there are in the San Antonio area, and there are 60 of them just within the San Antonio Beltway, and the majority of them are run by either DaVita or Renal Care.
Right, you go to pretty much any small town in Texas, you're going to find a Sonic and a dialysis center.
Yeah, unfortunately, that is the case. And those two phenomena go together, right, with poor nutrition leading to chronic disease, which inevitably leads to diabetes, hypertension, and then kidney disease, and then ultimately kidney failure.
Right, and the dialysis places will... They're getting government money. That's what keeps them going because many of the people, I mean, of course, people need dialysis.
Right.
But there seems to be a greased path in order to be able to provide that for them with the government money.
Yeah. And just a quick word on dialysis, and this is true for Medicaid dentistry too. Texas, by the way, seems to be ground zero for Medicaid dentistry. We can come back to that.
Yeah, we will.
Back to that. But dialysis is a volume business, right? So the centers are built, the chairs need to be filled for as much of the day as possible with as many patients as possible. And so there's an incentive there to have as many patients come into the center just to keep, just to keep those chairs filled. And the companies have gotten in trouble for paying doctors to refer patients. DaVita, in fact, had to settle with the federal government for charges of illegal kickbacks. In one case, a $350 million settlement, as a matter of fact. They use medication with each treatment, and dialysis, and DaVita got in trouble for that too. They had a $450 million settlement for wasting medication and billing Medicare for the excess. This company, by the way, that made $12 billion in 2023. And I pulled this number up the other day. They averaged 92,533 treatments per day. And the average revenues are about $370 per treatment. So that tells you both the volume of treatments that are going on and the volume of money that's going on. But it's also commentary on what's not happening with transplant, because another allegation that's been leveled against the dialysis companies is that they are not referring patients who are eligible for transplant to transplant. Now, the survival rate over 5 years, if you get a kidney transplant, is 90%. On dialysis, it's 40%. But the incentives push you toward, if you're a dialysis company, keeping somebody on dialysis and not, quote, losing that patient to transplant, which is what some kidney surgeons have actually told me have happened in the past with patients that they've seen. They were told by their dialysis provider that they should stay on dialysis for a little while, wait to get the transplant. Of course, the odds of successful transplant decline the longer you're on dialysis. So that's, an example of how the incentives in the industry can really damage the health and well-being of many vulnerable people.
So the idea is that if it's a government providing this government service, if the government's doing that, then there is waste, abuse, and fraud somehow in the system. And if we hand it over to a private company, then they're going to do it. They're going to fly right and just not have any of those waste items. And that's where they get their profit from. But is that true?
It is. That every industry has its bad actors. And for whatever reason, when you're talking about social services and particularly very large government programs, the incentives sometimes seem to be irresistible for companies to grab a little bit of extra. And particularly when you were talking about anti-poverty programs, where the outcomes are really hard to measure and the causes of poverty are so complex, it's hard to come up with the right incentives and hard to come up with the right disincentives so that companies seeking profit don't take advantage of both the program structure and B, the lack of oversight, because the federal government's infrastructure has really been hollowed out over the last 40 years, in part because of this push toward privatization. The ratio of government contractors to federal workers in HHS, to take one agency, is 36 to 1, 36 contractors for every one federal employee. So that tells you how much oversight is or is not happening because of the simple lack of capacity by the government to oversee all these contracts and make sure that this waste, fraud, and abuse isn't happening.
If you talk to someone like Matthew Desmond, he'll tell you this is poverty by design, that we keep people in poverty in order so that corporations can make their billions of dollars.
Yeah, he has a really good point here. And a lot of these companies have pretty powerful lobbying operations too, to make sure that their customer base, so to speak, remains intact. Back to the tax prep industry, for instance, there's been quite a lot of lobbying done by the tax preparation companies to ensure that tax simplification does not go through and that programs like the IRS Direct File, which allows you to file your taxes directly electronically with the IRS, don't happen. Because if we have a simpler tax code, or if we allow the IRS to allow electronic filing directly, what happens to the tax prep industry? It evaporates. Same with private prison companies, same with bail reform. I know in Texas that there have been some efforts around bail reform, primarily in Harris County, San
But the
Antonio.
state has pushed back on that.
Right, exactly. And the bail bond companies are right there, pushing against any sort of bail reform because their industry will disappear if cash bail disappears. And their primary market is low-income people who cannot afford to get themselves out of jail.
And so you say they are opportunistic, that they see an opportunity because a truism is that the poor pay more. If
That's exactly right.
you're low income, they're going to come after you because you don't have the resources to fight back. If you buy, the fun size items per ounce, it's much more expensive than if you buy the family size item. It's one of the truism of shopping and also trying to get by in a society. The poor pay more. And you see that in your writing, Kim and Anne.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And oftentimes those services are not only are often pretty substandard, So for instance, we talk about food deserts and who is providing, there's a lack of fresh produce, in many urban areas because the only source of food might be the dollar store, which often doesn't have fresh produce. Or housing vouchers. Now, the idea, the history behind housing vouchers was to break up concentrated poverty because back in the day, housing projects turned out to be not the best way to deal with the lack of affordable housing because you ended up with concentrated crime, the concentrated poverty, crime, all the things that, projects have a bad reputation for. And the idea of vouchers was to give people the freedom to be able to go to a neighborhood outside of a high poverty area and raise their children in an environment where they would have better access to schools, better services, et cetera. Unfortunately, the landlords that take so-called Section 8 housing choice vouchers are in the same neighborhoods where the projects were. And vouchers have not succeeded in breaking up concentrated poverty because there is an industry of landlords and real estate management companies, a lot of them owned by private equity, that specialize in taking housing voucher money. And oftentimes these the apartments, the housing provided by these companies is not only not in a great neighborhood, but not the great type of property either. In my reporting, I came across an entrepreneur named Peter Harris, who actually put up a blog post talking about how terrific it is to invest in Section 8 properties because the cash is constant. It comes straight from the government, so he doesn't have to worry about chasing down land tenants for rent. He doesn't have to provide very many amenities because the standards are pretty low. And he has a long wait list for prospective tenants to come in. So that program has unwittingly created an industry for people like this guy, Peter Harris, to come in, make a killing, provide the barest minimum in services, and do extremely well.
So we'll talk more about you get there's a lot in your book about public housing and the Section 8 vouchers and how this is providing so much money to private equity and investors, and whether or not that can be cleaned up in a way to we can get more bang for our buck, our tax dollars. But we're going to get into that when we come back from the break. We are talking about the book Poverty for Profit: How Corporations Get Rich Off America's Poor, with the author Ann Kim, a writer and a lawyer, public policy expert, contributing editor at Washington Monthly, where she was a senior writer. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. When we come back, I want to talk about dentistry on children, who it's horrific. It's a horrible story. But people need to know about this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The book is Poverty for Profit. We're joined by the author, Ann Kim. She's a writer, a lawyer, and a public policy expert. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And let's go to Carlos on the phones. And Carlos, you're on the air. And Carlos, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, sir, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, I've noticed a lot of those emergency room clinics / healthcare clinics opening around the city. I'm wondering if there's a link between all those clinics and the services the government pays for.
That's a good question, Carlos. Thanks for that. I wonder about that, too. So, Ann Kim, these are doc-in-a-box places that are happening, opening up all over.
Yeah, so I'm not sure that I could tell you exactly what the Medicare, Medicaid footprint is for these doc-in-a-box clinics, as you say. There is quite a proliferation of private equity's involvement in healthcare, though. There's a terrific book by Lehigh University professor Laura Katz Olson called Ethically Challenged, and it's about the, she calls it the storming of healthcare by private equity. 15% of all private equity acquisitions in recent years have been in the healthcare space. Private equity owns ophthalmology clinics, dental clinics, which we'll get to, dermatology, orthopedics, urgent care, which would include these doc-in-a-box places, emergency rooms, and their footprint is gigantic. And a lot of that money actually is probably coming from Medicare and Medicaid. Nursing homes, for example, are another industry where private equity has really made a huge play, and about 75% of the money that goes to private nursing homes comes from Medicare. So private equity senses the money that's there, and I'm sure what you're seeing is that, you know, seizure of the opportunity by, you know, as David said in the beginning, where the money is, that's where the money is, and that's where private equity and the corporations are headed.
Now the caller, Claiborne, and Claiborne, you're on the air.
Hi. Like a decade or so ago, I was reading an article about a book on the culture of poverty, which basically, by concentrating people in like Cabrini Green or the projects or whatever, you create a culture that is self-propagating and self-reinforcing, where the first bid in county jail is treated like graduating from high school, and there's an inverse, all these people hiding in gated communities, as opposed to way back when I was a child, my mother, grandparents, there were neighborhoods. One house might be a doctor, the people next door might be poor, but they all went to the same schools, the same churches, aspired to the same thing.
And so, Claiborne, tell me more. What is your question? Are you trying to link them? Because some people have said that poverty is a symptom of this, the disease of despair that we have in the country.
I'm going back to what you guys were saying a few minutes ago, which is by concentrating poverty, yes, or wealth, mm-hmm, and so forth and so on, that's dividing our culture and so forth and so on, and it creates these self-reinforcing things that are separate, as opposed to, like I said, back when every, you know, the neighborhood was the nominal distribution, and everybody aspired to the same thing, as opposed, right, to being going in completely different directions and services, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, I hear you. Yeah, Claiborne, so we're talking about learned helplessness and multi-generational poverty and corporations that are exploiting that and basically the poverty trap.
I think Claiborne's also alluding to what's called the neighborhood effect too. And a poor child who grows up in a neighborhood surrounded by people who have gone to college or who have work and who can provide opportunities and access to being able to ask someone for an internship, say, or, you know, ask someone how they applied to college. Like, that is a very powerful way of building social capital. And I think what the caller is saying, that when you have concentrated poverty, those sources of social capital also dry up and disappear. And you have these pockets where there are no jobs, there are no opportunities, but there are also no networks that enable people to rise.
So I have an email from Randall. He writes, it occurs to me that this problem parallels that of Medicare and Medicaid Advantage programs, whereby our nation's resources are bled to our detriment. I don't know what he means.
Yes. So Medicare is a program that the Republican-led administrations have very much tried to privatize. And Medicare Advantage actually is privatized Medicare. And Project 2025, which I know, David, you've featured, mm-hmm, on your show, a big part of the healthcare agenda involves a lot more privatization, including the wholesale privatization of Medicare into solely Medicare Advantage programs that are managed by insurance companies rather than traditional Medicare, where patients can go to the provider of their choice. So Medicaid Advantage is what we were talking about. I'm sorry, privatized Medicaid managed care is what we were talking about earlier with Maximus in a state, for instance, or what happened in Iowa, where you have these so-called capitated arrangements. And yes, it can lead often to the denial of care to people who most need it. It certainly leads to the bureaucratization of care because you have this layer of a contractor who's deciding whether you're entitled to a particular treatment or service or not. And the caller is right. In many instances, it can lead to pretty dire situations for patients.
So let's talk about this predatory dentistry that has happened and that you write about, particularly the over prescription of dentistry to children, this papoose board situation where these kids, what is all that?
Oh, yes, it's horrific. So Medicaid pays for routine dental care for children, not for adults. Unfortunately, a lot of dentists don't treat Medicaid patients. Then that, of course, created an opportunity for those dentists who would treat Medicaid patients and decide only to treat Medicaid patients. And what's also happened here, too, is that you've had the rise of a lot of franchise chains, primarily owned by private equity, that Cool Smiles, All Smiles, Pine Dentistry, there's all sorts of different franchise clinics that are out there that primarily treat children who are on Medicaid. And like dialysis, it's a volume business. So I went to see one of these clinics actually a few years back. I write about this. And the examination room is not like any dental examination, not like my dentist's office at all. There are five or six chairs kind of arranged like spokes in a wheel. So you could have five or six kids being treated at the same time by the dentists. And that kind of tells you that these places rely on high volume dentistry and oftentimes over-treatment of kids. And that's where the fraud and abuse have come in. Federal prosecutors went after a dentist in North Carolina who put 17 root canals into a toddler because you get paid by the root canal. So of course you have every incentive
Wait, say that again. 17
17,
root
according to the
canals
prosecutor, yeah.
into a toddler all at once.
All at once. And it's not uncommon. So this happened in Colorado, and that's what caused the ban on so-called papoose boards. Papoose boards are flat boards that are used to restrain a child. They're kind of like Velcro straps. They can't move their arms. And some of these Medicaid dentists were using papoose boards to restrain children while they're performing multiple procedures on a child in order to collect the Medicaid payments per treatment. So again, you could do five or six fillings at once. Maybe none of them were necessary, or baby root canals, or crowns on baby teeth on toddlers.
Because you go to some of these neighborhoods and you see little kids running around, and like all their teeth are silver. And it's like, what is going on here? And it's not a fashion statement. I guess they got wrapped into one of these programs.
Yeah, and for whatever reason, there was a lot of that happened in Texas over the past, couple decades. And WFAA in Dallas had done some terrific investigations over the past 10 years or so, finding some of these fraudsters. So, just an example of something that happened in Texas: the All Smiles chain operating in Texas in 2020, the owner was charged with 1,842 counts of Medicaid fraud, and he apparently charged $16.5 million in fees to Medicaid while he was on vacation. That's according to the federal indictment. There was another chain that was prosecuted in 2017 that had settled for $8.5 million, again for overbilling Medicaid, and again for these unnecessary procedures on children who were subjected to tremendous pain for root canals they didn't need, crowns they didn't need, fillings they may not have needed either.
So, and how do they, and parents would have to put their kids in a program like that?
Well, if you don't have access to dental care otherwise, and this is a real problem here because oftentimes the only dental care that's available to poor children is from a Medicaid dentist. And these clinics look pretty spiffy. You know, they have bright colors. Like the one that I went to is called the Cool Smiles Clinic, owned by a company called Benevis, which is owned by a private equity firm. It had a little, you know, playground thing in the lobby. The colors were bright. They look very spiffy. You know, it seems very professional. And that's because they're making lots of money charging Medicaid for these procedures. But there aren't very many options for low-income people. And that's another problem that I think is a huge consequence of the rise of Poverty Inc. You have no choice. You have very few choices.
These are vulnerable people.
Right, who are trapped. This is who you're stuck with for your dental care. A dentist who is going to overcharge you and give you treatments you don't need. This is who you're stuck with dialysis. A monopolist firm that's not going to send you to a transplant if you need one. You're going to be stuck with the landlord that's going to give you the substandard apartment, and you're going to be stuck with the dollar store where you can't get fresh fruit.
Let's take a break. We're going to continue our conversation. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, toll roads, private prisons, all sorts of ways that they get you. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin. Davies Ann Kim has written the book, The Poverty for Profit. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255. You write in the conclusion, in a perfect world, the goal should be to expunge the parasitic industries dragging down U.S. anti-poverty efforts and to eliminate the failures in policy that have allowed this kind of corporate opportunism. Getting there will require a fundamental reexamination of who is really running the machinery of U.S. social policy and, in fact, who benefits most. And to accomplish this task, policymakers should keep in mind the following five takeaways. So let's go over these. You want to make sure that people recognize that the government doesn't deliver anti-poverty programs. Private actors do. Why do we need to know that?
Well, I think we need to know that because we need to hold these companies accountable for their performance or lack thereof. I think in our public discourse, there's a lot of blame that's directed toward either government or in many cases, frankly, directed toward the poor and the so-called choices, personal responsibility again. But what that does when you have that kind of bifurcated debate is that we're leaving the corporations, the companies that are running the programs out of the equation altogether.
They're off the hook.
Right, exactly. Giving them a pass. So I'm hoping with this book to bring that third party into the conversation and say, look, here is a major reason why anti-poverty programs aren't performing the way that the public wants them to, because there's been a huge lack of accountability on the part of corporations that are running the war on poverty on behalf of the government, but maybe not doing such a great job because they're profiting for themselves.
Number two, poverty persists in part because it benefits the industries that profit. Tell us more.
Right. Yes. And here we're talking about, in part, the lobbying efforts by private prison companies, by bail bondsmen, by tax prep, but also the kind of the structural disadvantages that aren't being tackled at all. Because, again, you know, our public discourse around poverty is just primarily about individual responsibility and demanding work, for instance, from welfare recipients when there is no work to be had.
Right. And that gets into number three, personal responsibility is a myth when the poverty industry controls people's choices. How are they controlling people's choices?
Yeah. And this is something I was alluding to earlier about the lack of options. You know, when you have substandard housing because that's what your Section 8 landlord offers you, or you have substandard health care because that's all the Medicaid dentist is your only option for dental care. Or the extremely substandard job training provider, which we haven't gotten into, isn't able to provide you with the education that you need in order to land a living wage job. When your choices are constrained by the incompetence or inattention or malice of the people providing the services, there's no way you're going to get ahead. And that's what I mean by that. Of course, personal responsibility does matter, but the universe of choices that are available to you matter just as much or more.
So real quickly, let's hit that thing about job training. Government money is available for people to take online courses in cake decorating, and for which there are no jobs, and from which you, when you graduate, you really don't know how to do it. I mean, what is all that?
Oh, right. So the federal workforce training programs allow you to have, again, a voucher to go and find job training from what's called an eligible training provider list. And that's a list of training providers who have allegedly been vetted by the state and approved to take federal money to train you. Unfortunately, that list often includes, in many states, places like the one you mentioned, which is a college, quote unquote, in California that had the online cake decorating class for some ungodly amount of money. There's another great example that I found of what's called the Animal Behavior College in Valencia, California, another California school. They had a $6,300 online dog grooming class. They're one of the few programs that actually provided what happened to the graduates. And the graduates are earning $5,000 a year, 6 months after graduation. And so they're not even making back what they paid for this class. And the federal government is supporting programs like this because the oversight over job training is really just abysmal. And that's another instance of the paucity of good choices available if you're in this dire situation of wanting to upskill yourself or train. These are the providers that you might be stuck with.
Back to your conclusion takeaways. Number four, we need better governance and a lot more of it. There's so much. You know, there's lobbyists, there's kickbacks, there's bad actors involved here. I mean, can really government fix this?
I think it's a long-term project. You know, the privatization train started rolling 40 years ago. So this is not a problem that's going to be solved under one administration, let alone two. However, you know, the first rule of holes is to stop digging, right? So I think one of the things that has to happen is to stop the continual privatization of more and more and more and more of government. And then little by little for government to claw back some of the authority that it has abdicated to companies. For instance, shouldn't mission-driven government career officials be deciding whether someone is entitled to healthcare or rather than a company, you know, or making life or death decisions about whether that person is entitled to a particular treatment? There are some things that, of course, private sector can do better, such as database management, say, or, you know, garbage collection, sure. But when it comes to life and death decisions that affect someone's well-being and welfare going forward, those things may not belong in the private sector's hands. And that's what I mean by clawing back some of the authority that the government has given away over the past 40 years.
Number five, your final point here in your conclusion. More funding for federal anti-poverty programs won't solve the problem of poverty, but it will feed the poverty industry. Now, that sounds like an argument for let's stop funding these programs.
No, I don't mean it that way. I mean it as a warning to progressives in a sense. Oftentimes the debate in Congress is, well, this program isn't working because we're not spending enough. And that is true up to a certain point. But if we're not spending the money that we're already spending wisely, then more money is not going to solve the problem. If you put more money into job training, for instance, that means more money is going to Animal and Behavior College, you know, or if you put more money into tax credits, that could mean, you know, higher fees for the tax prep industry. There are unintended consequences of just more money into a program. What I'm saying is that, yes, we need more resources, sure, but we also need to make sure that those resources are going where they're supposed to go and not being diverted by this constellation of middlemen that I've identified in the book that are taking advantage of the size and the inefficiency of government programs to help the poor.
Yeah, that's why I wonder when I hear Kamala Harris talking about giving a $25,000 credit for first-time home buyers, I wonder if that's just going to raise the price of homes. You know, it's complicated and there's unintended consequences anytime you enter into the market. But as I read, you know, you read through your book, I'm wondering, like, where are the nonprofits? Why can't we have nonprofits, a check cashing place, do some of this work and be able to do it better and cheaper and with public interest in mind?
Yeah, you know, just being a nonprofit doesn't always solve the problem. I don't go into it, but there are definitely nonprofits that have gotten into similar kinds of trouble. On the other hand, I agree with you that the profit motive often creates incentives that can be malign. And particularly when you're talking about a public company that has to answer to its shareholders and investors first, and taxpayers and the public second or third or last, for that matter, then you have all sorts of incentives to squeeze as much money out of government programs as possible for the least possible cost without regard to what happens to the end user of that product or service, which is the vulnerable person who's supposed to be benefiting.
But these corporations, they have a lot of lobbying power. You mentioned the tax preparation companies. They are very active in on Capitol Hill, making sure that I have to buy a new copy of TurboTax every year.
Yeah. No, that's right. The right to petition your government is enshrined in the Constitution, so there's not much we can do about the actual fact of that. There's a lot more probably that can be done around making sure that, ordinary citizens are aware of the amount of lobbying that goes on. And I wonder about the ability of government contractors to use government money to lobby. I'm not sure they should be allowed to do that. And there are certainly many companies that get a substantial portion of the revenues from government dollars, and they should not be allowed to turn around and use that very same money to lobby for contracts that keep their, businesses, their revenues flowing. So there might be some solutions in there to kind of staunch the amount of lobbying that goes on in certain industries by certain companies.
So you say that there's some privatization that works well. You mentioned garbage collection. I don't know why that's a good example, but I wonder about private utilities. You don't write about that, but we saw recently in Texas with CenterPoint in Houston why private utilities will frequently let down their services. I'm so glad that we have a municipally owned utility here in San Antonio, but it just seems overwhelmingly evident that. Let these private companies aren't going to have the best interests of the public. I mean, real quickly, what's your response?
Yeah, no, I agree. I looked only at anti-poverty programs, but I agree with you that there's a privatization, there's an infiltration of privatization in everything. And I would recommend a great book called The Privatization of Everything by Donald Cohen and Alan McKeelian that looks exactly at this problem of privatization in infrastructure, in public schools, in other arenas where government again has really abdicated its footprint to the detriment of the public and has created all sorts of problems while these companies prosper. In my book, I looked just specifically at
Right.
how the lowest income people, most vulnerable people, can sometimes suffer as a result.
And Kim, she's a writer, a lawyer, a public policy expert. Her latest book is Poverty for Profit. And thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.